This is Casey Current. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Poet, activist, one of the architects of Black Studies programs at universities. These are some of the many facets of Sonia Sanchez. In the late 60s and 70s, her poetry reverberated the themes of reclaiming Black identity and self-determination. Sanchez has been called one of the most important writers of the Black arts movement. At 77, she still lectures internationally on Black culture and literature, women's liberation, peace, and racial justice. Sonia Sanchez was recently invited to Kansas City by UMKC's Black Studies Department. I interviewed her about her life and career in front of an audience at UMKC 2 weeks ago, just before her reading. Let's start at the beginning. You were born in Birmingham and really coped with tragedy and displacement in your life, and I think it's a testimony of how people can channel pain into beautiful art. How did those experiences really affect you and influence you to be a writer?
Well, I'm not too sure that it is the pain that has propelled me as a writer. I think that it probably has been the beauty of someone like my grandmother in a place called Birmingham, Alabama. The memories of ants in the house, the memories of me as a child running, I guess in a sense, wildly wild in Birmingham, Alabama. I ran with the boys, you know, which meant that they ran. You got up in the morning and they were out all day long running, climbing trees and getting in trouble. And that's what I did, and my grandmother let me do that. I had a sister who was just beautiful. I mean, she was drippingly beautiful, you know. My sister would wake up in the morning, everybody would pat, you know, whatever, you know. And she didn't have to do anything except show up, right? And she'd go outside to play. And you know how they used to dress you in these cute little dresses and stuff, right? And, you know, the pigtails and the ribbons and stuff. And my sister would go out and play, and at the end of the day, she came back looking the same way. And I used to say to her, "What do you do outside?" I knew she didn't play. It's very hard being beautiful, people, you know. Make no mistake about it. You know, it's a hard job. And I came back in with pigtails out and dress torn, and my aunts, you know, it was a house of women, my grandmother, mama, and they were really first cousins, but they were older, so we called them aunt, you know, our Aunt Ruth, and they would just cluck their tongues and say, this child just ain't going to grow up to be a lady, and there was some good in that, you know. And as a consequence, you know, I was always kind of like in trouble. And I remember distinctly being outside with the young brothers one day, and there was this big fight who was going to be the leader, you know. And someone decided, well, let's do something spectacular, and the one who did it would be the leader. So I suggested that we go in my house, and I could jump out of the second-story window. Someone could do that, right? You know, and it's one of those houses where it really was not second, but like one and a half, right? McWinder. So we got there. But you see, I never do anything unless I look and make sure what's happening. So I looked out the window and saw this. We had this big tree, and I figured I could jump far enough, hit the tree, and then slide down. So I said, I'm going to do this, right? And the moment I said, I'm going to do this, the children, they ran out of down the steps, and they went and told my aunts. Oh, and my grandmother. And by the time they had done that, I jumped out the window, hit the tree too hard, which meant I came down too hard, and I, you know, hit my knees. And my aunts came out clucking their tongues, you know, like, see, look, Mama, what are we going to do with this girl? And my grandmother, Mama came out and said, just let the girl be. You know, she said, you okay, honey? And they went and got something, wiped my knees off, and then I turned around and said, okay, people, I'm it. I'm the leader. But being children, by the second day, you know, there was no leader. You know, we just went out and played, but just for the moment. So I have those great memories. I have those memories also of one of my aunts taking me on a bus to work with her. And, you know, in those days, you got on buses and you sat in the back, right? Black folks did. And then the bus got full. It was a bus going to work. People were going to work. And so the bus driver said, get up. And so we stood up. And then it got so crowded, we had to, like, you know, really, you know, move kind of forward. And then the bus driver, it got full. The bus driver said to the blacks, then get off the bus so whites could stand up. And my Aunt Pauline refused. And I remember being little, looking up like this at all the activity. And the bus driver said something, if you don't get off, I'm going to stop this bus and do whatever. And he stopped the bus and got ready to grab her, and she spit in his face. And I remember that they took us off, and we went to jail, and the family came. And I remember feeling little, looking up at her in a different way. But I know that because my dad was a school teacher, a man who owned a juke joint and was one of the first black jazz musicians, that I know they got her out of town that night. That's the South. As a black, you do something, you are then shepherded out, you know, that night. But I remember, you know, I remember that incident, and I wrote about it. I carry that memory with me, you know. I remember being in a elevator with Mama, and someone came up to us and said, oh, what cute little children, you know, and tried to pat us on the head. And Mama, who was a very quiet Southern woman, right? Christian woman. And she said, don't touch my children, right, you know. And but then something just happened to me. I'm in the midst of doing a memoir, my dear sister. And I asked for a picture, a big picture of my grandmother, Mama, this woman I call Mama, this woman that I'll read a piece that I did about her and all the sisters who ran the church, Amy Zion Church, in a place called Birmingham, Alabama. They sent me the picture of this big, portly woman with these high cheekbones and with this one braid down her back. And I said, oh, they made a mistake. This is a Native American. And I called and said, hey, I think you made a mistake here. They said, no, that's Mama. And I said, that's not the memory I have of my grandmother. And they say, yeah, she always had. But then I realized I am this 2-year-old, this 3-year-old, this 4-year-old, this 5-year-old, this 6-year-old, you know. But she had always wore the one long braid down the back. And then on the back, it says she was born, nay, in Canada. You know, so I was completely just thrown. And I realized at some point that my father's father, my grandfather, who worked on the railroad, had gone up to Canada and brought it back to a place called Birmingham, Alabama. So it's a lot of tracing one has to do. Also, in conclusion with this one question, I went south for the first time many years ago to read at the University of Alabama, and some black students picked me up. There were some grad students there with me, and they said, will you say something to the president about, you know, we're in the university, and we have no money, and we're in grad school. So, of course, I got up on stage, you know. And I thanked the president for being there. And then I turned and said, you know, these students need more money. For grad school, the students thought I wasn't going to do it. But, you know, you got to always be advocate for students. Now, I was there. Yeah. That's why we're here. You know, always. You know, always helping you at some point to answer the question that we started answering in the 20th century, and now we're in the 21st century, what does it mean to be human? That's what this was all about, you know. That's why we started making the university human, you know, making it less elitist, you know, bringing in people, you know, people who were poor, you know, people who were black, Latino, you know, people who were Asian, you know, people who were Native Americans, you know. That's we open up our class to students who were gay and lesbian, you know, and say, hey, everybody comes in this classroom. You got to hear that. You got to understand that, you know. And there was a lot of flack as a consequence of that, because people have very distinct, you know, attitudes. But, you know, we did that. And all that came from this woman, Mama, you know, who really allowed me to be, you know, kind of like, you know, she let me run and be what I wanted to be. And she didn't hold me to the standards of my sister or the aunts in the house. And I am, forever indebted to her, you know, for that, for just letting me, in a sense, you know, grow up and, you know, for at least until I was 6 years of age. They let me go to school at 4, if you're ready for that, because they said she'll get bored. And then, of course, when it was time to be promoted, you know, because my dad was a school teacher, they let me go on, you know. And so I have always been that child who has loved books. And always when my grandmother died, when Mama died, we were sent out amongst relatives and people. And I always had a book in my hand. But also after she died, I became that stutterer. So I'm the child that would, And then, you know, and they would say, you know, as we went to various places, various homes, they said, oh, Pat, isn't she beautiful? And I have a long haiku poem to my sister, because I really mean it when I say my sister, that people don't really like beauty, you know, especially beautiful little children, you know. They will try to destroy that beauty. And the thing that saved me is because I was indeed the stutterer with the book. And so what they did is they just give her a book and put her in a corner. And that really saved my life on many levels.
Yeah. And I understand started writing then at a young age.
Right, mm-hmm. I did. I used to write these little ditties, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you know, what that's about. And they halfway knew that I wrote. But I really did not, they didn't really discover my writing until my dad brought us to New York when I was 8 years of age, brought us to Harlem. And, I would write and hide my stuff, you know. I had my notebooks, and people call them journals now, right, you know. But I would hide them. And because I took care, my job on Saturdays was to clean the kitchen and the bathroom. We had those old-fashioned tubs that you pay a lot of money for now as antiques, you know, right. I would hide them underneath the tub, right. And because I cleaned the bathroom, no one ever found them. I kept those. And one day they discovered, I left one of my poems on a bed, in our bedroom, and my sister picked me home from school for George Washington's birthday. The teacher asked us to write an essay or a poem about George Washington, and I wrote a poem about George Washington crossing the Delaware, right? And my sister found it and came into the kitchen there in Harlem and read it. And I remember grabbing it and then making sure I always hit my poems. It is something that I realized that probably saved my life on many levels. It is something I did. And as my dad said to me before he died, he said, I don't know what happened to you, Sonia, because you were such a quiet child. You know, I was. I liked school. So, I mean, you know, and I was young. So my dad would send me out with my sister and Sylvia, Grace and Maria and my sister, Pat. I was the 2 years younger than they, so I was one who would say to them, it's time to go home, it's 11 o'clock, so they hated me, you know, I mean, really, and I had to go out with them all the time, you know, that's what I came up with, you know, and so they're the ones who would, you know, get dressed up in these pretty little dresses, and then my stepmother would, you know, do my sister's hair because it was nice and straight, right? And then she said, I'll do your last, Sonia, because, you know, it was a little kinkier and curlier. And so they would say with a straight face, we will wait for you, Sonia, in the mini park. And I said, okay. And so I would be finished with the hair, and I'd go running outside. And, of course, they were not in the mini park, right? So then anyone who knows New York, some of the best basketball players used to play on the basketball court at 152nd Street in St. Nicholas Place. You know, they could beat the City College people. I mean, they were great players. And all the young girls like my sister and Sylvia and Grace and Maria would go and stand and lean against the fence beautifully, you know, whatever. So I went up there, trekking up there, and they weren't there. So then I said, they must have gone down to Riverside Drive, you know, where we all, and I went over there to Riverside Drive, went all the way down to the river. They went there. And I came back. I was so tired. And I had cousins who lived at 147th Street in Broadway. And I went in and just, I was asking for some lemonade. I was so hot and sweating. I said, oh, come on, Sonia. I love those cousins because they had a library. I mean, a library. You open the doors and just books, you know. Mm. And so they brought in some lemonade. My sister and I went in and stretched out with books just stacked up like this, right? Drinking the lemonade, and I went to sleep. And I woke up, it was 7 o'clock. Wow. And I ran out of, they said, we didn't know you were still, you know, here, and I ran all the way home. And, you know, this is one of the things that has propelled me most of my life, that's what I'm going to say now. I turned the corner at 151st Street, and there was my sister, Sylvia, Maria, Pat, and Grace standing there. I said, ooh, where were you? And I said, I went looking for you. Oh, we were in the mini park waiting for you. And I said, no, you weren't, because my dad was furious. My dad was scared. My dad, you know, when parents can't locate you. And my dad never hit me at all. And so he said to my stepmother, just go give Sonia a spanking for doing this. And I kept saying, no, no, no. They're not telling the truth. They're lying. And no one listened because the four of them was just standing up. Oh, no, we were in the park and she never showed up and blah, blah, blah. And so, but I had a step, this stepmother was a really, Jerry was a really wonderful woman, a very gentle woman and an unsung artist, you know, painter. And so what she would do is that she took out the little brush and she hit you once. All you had to do was just go, ah, and she stopped. But you got to hear this. I looked her straight in the face and said, they were lying, and this is an unjust spanking. I will not cry.
That sounds like it was the voice of resistance.
Oh, my God, you know. So she went, boom, and I said again, this is an unjust spanking. I will not cry. So she hit again, but she's a gentle woman. After about five, she gave up. And then I turned and said, announced at the dinner table, and I am not going to lie like my sister is lying, right? You know, because this is how you survive childhood. Boom. Well, you know, so my family, but it's true, you know. And then I finally told my father, I cannot tag behind them anymore because you talk about haters. They were like haters.
The original haters. Now, speaking of New York and fast forwarding, you participated in a writer's workshop in Greenwich Village, and there were all kinds of luminaries in the Black Arts Movement.
Yeah, the scholar who wrote that got it wrong. After I graduated from Hunter, and I was waiting to teach, right? I went back to school, went to grad school. In the midst of going to grad school, I looked at the catalog because I wanted to take a writing class, right? And lo and behold, there was a creative writing class, poetry class, taught by a woman by the name of Louise Bogan. For you writers here, one of the most important American poets, you know, here. She was teaching at NYU. But I had all kinds of difficulty of going into workshops, being one, the only female, you got to hear this, you know, and the only Black. And I raised my hand to say something and completely ignored. So after about two sessions, I would leave. So I'm here. I haven't registered. I'm sitting by the door, and it's a class of 45 people, right? And I'm looking around. There was only two other women, and my three women in a class of 45, and I was the only Black. So I'm looking at this woman, Louise Bogan. She's the poetry editor of The New Yorker. I read her work, and I said, let's see what the deal is here, right? So she said, the first night she talked about what we were going to do, and then she said, does anyone have a poem? No, does anyone have a poem here? That's like asking an alcoholic, you know, if he or she has a bottle in the house, people, you know, whatever. We all pulled our poems out of pockets, jackets, purses, whatever, briefcases, whatever. And I raised my hand, said, you might as well find out the deal now. So I raised my hand, went up front and read the poem. And everybody raised a hand to respond to it. I said, I'm going to stay. You know, and I stayed there for 1 year. The thing that Bogan did, which I did, I mean, everything I learned in that class over the years, right, with her, I taught in the same. But first of all, she taught us form. She said, you might write vers libre, she said, but you better know form, whatever. So, and we moaned in that workshop. I can still hear my moan, right, you know? We moaned in that workshop, but we understood finally at some point that you had to understand there was form involved with free verse. And then the other thing, she taught us also how to send work out. She sent us to the 8th Street Bookstore, to find out the kind of poetry that would fit into some of these places, you know, some of the journals like the Transatlantic, the Paris Review, all these reviews, right? And then she said, send no more than 3 poems, whatever. So I did a notebook of about 15 pages, the different places, you know, to send work out. And I was telling that very nice English class, creative writing class I went to this morning, that I sent the poem out. The first time I sent a bunch of them out, about 5, and by the time I got home, it had been returned, right, you know? And with the thing, the editors, right? The good thing is that Bogan kept saying, send your work out. You're going to find out some things. And it was in that class, during that time, my dear sister, that I got a poem published, 2 poems published in the Transatlantic Review, you know? And at that time, I got a letter back from George Garrett, who said, your poetry also would have been in this issue, except we just had so many poems, you know, whatever. Send us some more poetry. I saw Garrett some year, George Garrett, some years ago, walked up to him, you know. He said, you know, oh, you're the Sanchez. I said, yeah, I'm the one over these years, right. It was interesting. But to make a long story short, I brought bottles of wine into NYU, right? Because Bogan drank, you know. I mean, she was a drinker, so we got in with cups and whatever, and we celebrated, you know, that being published there in that workshop. I was the only one in that class who did get published, and from that group, I can't think of the brother's name now. He said, "You, 10 of us, let's meet in the village," and let's continue the workshop after that year. And so we met on Charles Street. And we met about 2 years. And during that time, the next year, I began to publish, you know. And it got tricky. And I always tell people, you know, workshop, you got to know when to get out, because it got to be tricky that I was the only one publishing in that workshop. And that got to be really tricky in that I stopped saying I published, you know, whatever. I just went. The only thing you had to do was you had to have a poem every Wednesday night. You know, you couldn't come. So sometimes I'd be sitting downstairs in my little Volkswagen, you know, because you've been working during the day, you know, writing a poem to go in, you know, so you could be in the workshop. But we met all those years. And I'll tell you how I met Baraka at that time. After we would do a workshop, we'd go to the 5 Spot. You know, we walked into the 5 Spot, and someone said, there's Leroy Jones there. And he had his hat sitting acey-deucey. You know, he had a Boilermaker there. He had a little notebook writing, and he was smoking a gold-tipped cigarette, right? And so we passed by, and I heard a voice say, Sanchez! And I jumped, almost like a stutter, you know? And I turned around and said, yes. He said, I'm editing a journal for Paris, France. Send me some of your poetry. And I said, I mean, I don't think I said that. Yeah, I nodded my head and kept going. And everyone said, oh, you know what? I said, yeah, I know what that was. He said, you're going to send the poetry? And I said, oh, you know, he doesn't want my poetry. You know, I mean, I said, he doesn't even know me, you know, I've just been publishing in little magazines, right? And maybe about 3 weeks later, we come back into the 5 Spot to hear some jazz. And he was sitting there again. And so I just walked right past, and I heard this voice of Sanchez, you don't want to be in the magazine then. And I turned at that point and said, were you serious? He said, well, I asked you, didn't I, right? And so I left everybody there in the 5 Spot and got in my VW, went up the west side. I made my apartment on Riverside Drive in 5 minutes from the village. You know, went and pulled out my little typewriter, pulled out my, you know, my poems, and did a big typing job, and then came back outside to mail it at the post office downtown. I wasn't going to wait until the next day. About 2 weeks later, I got a note from him that said, Dear Sonia, yeah. That's all. Just yeah. And he accepted the poems, right. So that was the workshop that I did for about 2 to 3 years in the village. Mm-hmm.
Now, you joined the Nation of Islam. What led you to join? And then when you found out that you were facing oppression from your own, did that shock you and surprise you? And what did you end up doing about it?
Well, no, what happened? You have to understand that most of the writers we knew had embraced some kind of Islam, from Baraka to Askia. I mean, they all people changed their names. They took Islamic names. Most of the people I knew were looking at a man by the name of Malcolm, right? And what that meant to them was the kind of change about that. Most of the people I knew also at some point looked around and said that one of the most progressive things that they saw happening in America, you know, was at that time the nation in terms of schooling the children, in terms of politics, in terms of buying land, in terms of owning land, in terms of owning property, whatever, and owning bookstores, whatever. So that's why a lot of people, you know, gravitated towards, you know, that at that particular time. What happened to many of us also, too, is that it was a place for a lot of women for protection also, too. You see, people forget that many of us were out there on our own, and we were challenging a place called America. And many people, some people had been killed, some people went to jail, and many people really at some point needed an anchor of sorts. And so the nation was an anchor for me on many levels, where I was able to see my children, you know, go to school, have a place, whatever. And then at some point, you felt some kind of protection, because once you went into the nation, there was protection, whatever. I mean, there was indeed. There were problems in the nation, because there are many people, the captain in New York City said that I was a Pan-Africanist, and what was I doing in the nation? That I was a woman who traveled by herself, you know, and read, and I really needed to be home. And someone said that I needed to be home and have some babies, and I said I already had children. You know, so there was a constant, I would say, dialogue between us. One of the most fascinating things that I did in the nation, however, was I had a column. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but I made a place for children to write their work. I go all the way around the world to this day. Around the world, people walk up to me and say, "You chose a poem of mine in Muhammad Speaks." So I had in fact, it was a bone of contention in the nation. They said, "How could I have a full center page?" That's what I had: children's work and then women's, whatever. So people wrote. So I wrote, you know, and I wrote about all issues, and probably that's how I got in trouble, you know. But I understood one thing. I didn't know it was limited. I mean, I know how I have framed my life at some point, you know, that I had to look up and see where I was at some point in my life. And I also knew at some point that what I felt about the world, because I was in New York Corps. And CORE was a very important organization for me. And I was one of the people who founded Black Studies. So this was a completely different thing for me. People said, "Did you feel suppressed as a woman?" Well, you know, when I went to Chicago to work, I went as the head of I was the head of the cultural. They actually formed a cultural department for me there. And what I did is that for the nation, I opened the nation up. I brought Shirley Graham Du Bois, who was my mentor, to come give a lecture there at the Nation of Islam. I brought Max Roach to come do jazz, you know, there. I mean, I brought Kariamu Welsh to come in to bring her dance troupe in. I brought Gwendolyn Brooks and Margaret Burroughs and Val Ray Ward, you know, to read their poetry, whatever. You see, you don't let people limit you wherever you go. And my point was that wherever I was in New York Corps in Black Studies, because people tried to limit you in Black Studies also too, or in the nation, right? I said, you're not going to limit me, because there's something that goes on in organizations when people see you as an artist that it bothers them, you know, like no one really trusts the artist. You know, they think the artist is always subversive, and that's true, you know. And you better be subversive, yes. Right.
Now, we're getting to the end of our time. Two mm-hmm. questions that I have to ask you, and mm-hmm. one is, you mentioned your founding of Black Studies. Mm-hmm. First of all, how did you convince the university to do a Black Studies program, and how do you think, as you look at ethnic studies programs now, how do you think the challenges now are even different?
Well, I mean, I wasn't the originator of it. The great thing about Black Studies is that it came from students. You know, I will never forget. I keep telling people that this movement that is going on now with people, you know, who are sitting in, you know, the occupiers now, a very important movement. You know, you don't kick them. You got to go. And I was up at Yale, right? And after I gave the speech and people were saying, oh, the students, whatever, I was on the bus being taken back to a hotel, and I said to the bus driver, can you tell me where the occupiers are here, you know, here? And he said, oh, right down the street in the park. So I said, well, can you drop me off? Because I want to greet them. I want to hug them. I want to tell them what an important thing they're doing. They need to know that. They really need to know that. And so I said, drop me off, and I'll figure out how to get back to the hotel. And he said a very interesting thing. He said, Professor Sanchez, I will drop you off, but I will wait for you. And so he said, the rest of the people should get off, too. And when he dropped... But most of them didn't. But Professor Bracey, John Bracey, got off. Professor Nell Painter from Princeton got off. And there were about 4 grad students who got off. And the rest sat on that bus, you know. And they were, I think, maybe they could have been annoyed that we, you know, kept it. But that brother, who was a worker, you know, said we will wait. And we had to jump a fence to get to it. You know, you see how tall I am, you know. And we went and we hugged them and thanked them and talked about that they were part of a long American tradition, you know, of resistance, you know, always resist, you know, in this place called America, right? And always bring up that which is incorrect in America, you know, period. You got to do it. And you know, so I wanted to mention that. So we did that. So when I taught at Pittsburgh, as you said, University of Pitt, I introduced the first course called The Black Woman in America. It happened there, but I can't take credit for it because what happened, I said offhandedly to students, to these black women students, I said, oh, gosh, you're always in my office, you know. I got to go home at 7:30. And I said offhandedly, sometimes I think we need a course. Never, ever say that around students. The next morning at 8 o'clock, I come to open up my office door. 10 of them are lined up outside the office door, and they will say to me, you're right, we need a course, you know, and you need to teach it, you know. And that's how we got the black woman. But it came from students. Black studies came from students, came from a lot of students that came out of SNCC, you know, with the idea of, like, we need to change the whole university system. It was not just introducing black studies courses. It was like opening up the university. It was making them, like, in a sense, get fine money for students so they could come, you know, open enrollment. That's a major thing, open enrollment, you know, whatever. What we saw happening there was the idea of opening up the university to people who were poor, to people who were black, Asian, you know, Latino, whatever, Native American, just open it up and say, let these people, this is not going to be elitism anymore. So that's what we did. And then the professors came. I was in walking down El Paseo de la Reforma in Mexico, and four people were calling my name from a bus. And I said, oh, God, not even in Mexico City, right, you know. Brother Chuck and Brother Jimmy and two sisters from SNCC were there in Mexico, and they said, we've been writing you letters to come out and teach. And I said, because it was after Malcolm's assassination, I said, anything that is called black will get destroyed. I was distraught. I had come to Mexico to climb the pyramids, to, in a sense, to forget that Malcolm had been assassinated in this country. And we hung out together. And then later on, that fall, they came to New York, and we talked. I took them to meet Baraka in Newark and Larry Neal in Newark. And that night, we all decided to come to San Francisco State. you know. And my father kept saying, you cannot go to San Francisco State, you know. That's all the way 3,000 miles away, you know. And we came there. What you don't know is that the first semester we taught without getting paid, because the president said, oh, I didn't say you could have black studies. So one of the things you ever noticed after that, every time we had a meeting with a president or we brought a tape recorder in. And we taped everything. Everything, you know, so therefore we could later on play it back. So yes, you did say we could have black studies. But we had people coming in taking courses without credit, but they were packed courses, okay? And then, you know, the university is indeed a corporation. You think it's under the guise of an educational system. It's a corporation. And they said, all that money we missed the first semester, right? And then they open up and they got the money, and a lot of money they got from that. I'm not too sure if it, you know, really pays to constantly say if ethnic studies can replace black studies or whatever. I know out of black studies, teaching there, out of black studies came while we were there, you know, women's studies, Asian studies, right, Puerto Rican studies. I mean, all of that came. I was in a classroom teaching my lit class, and some on the way in, we were doing so much research, right? And someone handed me this, you know, this and said, here, look, this is a copy of a poster. We think it's about concentration camps. So I read it and went into my class. I had two Japanese-American students in my lit class, and I said, look at this. Do you know anything about concentration camps? And they got pissed at me. Concentration camps. I said, we think Japanese-Americans were put in concentration camps. They said, no. I mean, they just got really furious. Well, you know, I let it go. But when they went on their way out, I said, why don't you take it with you and ask? They came back in that class on Tuesday morning with tears in their eyes because they went home and asked their parents about concentration camps, and their parents told them, yes, that they had been in concentration camps, the silences. And so what happened, whether you call it ethnic studies or black studies or African-American studies or Pan-African studies or whatever you call it, whether you call it women's studies, you know, or whether you call it Asian studies or Puerto Rican studies or Chicano studies, whatever you call it, what you have got to understand is what, like where it came from and how we must work together always moving together, you know, against, you know, any kind of oppression that happens in the university. Wow.
So, of course, you've received so many awards, accolades for such a prolific career. But what are you proudest of? What do you see as your main legacy?
Whew. I don't think you end up with just one legacy. You know, I travel around a lot, university. I see former students. I see one here. There's a couple other former students here that I've seen. I even see, you know, and they're professors, you know, and I know they're continuing that great tradition. There's no one legacy. I mean, if one has got to zero it down to one thing, that I walked upright as a human being, you know, and along the way I taught, you know, along the way, you know, I had children that I'm very proud of. Along the way, I met people that I have loved. Along the way, I got on stages with people and performed, you know. I performed with a man by the name of Max Roach at the San Francisco Opera House, you know. You know, that I have been on stages with Def and Talib, you know, and mess with them on stage, you know what I mean? Like, you know, to like make sure they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, you know. That I've been and panel discussions with people where we have argued, whatever, and then gotten up and hugged them and said, thank you. You know, I'm going to really, at some point, you know, maybe think about what you just said, but never disrespected each other. Arguing doesn't mean you disrespect each other, whatever. You can disagree. That, I guess, being a part of, I've been a part of a number of the civil rights movement, right, the black arts movement, the black studies movement, the women's movement, right? And the peace movement. You know, those are five major movements that I have dealt with in my time as an African-American. And at this time, what I'm doing, people wanted to do a mural of me. And I said, I passed some of the, bookmarks out. And I said, why don't we do a peace mural instead? Why don't we do a peace mural? You know, I said, you know, that would be me. You know, so I got on the telephone. I called Sister Maya and Sister Alice and Sister Tony, and I said, "Hey, I need three lines from you because I'm calling this peace is a haiku song, right? And I want you to send me three lines about peace." And Tony Morrison sent me three lines, and Alice Walker sent me three lines, and Maya Angelou sent me three lines. And then last week I was in New York. It's the anniversary of What's Going On, that great, 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 great man who did that song, What's Going On, right? What's his name?
Marvin Gaye.
Got it. Marvin Gaye. I mean, he did that, and so Carmen and I were up there talking about where we were, you know, how important it was, and we discussed that whole thing. And when I was there, you know, he came up and picked me up and hugged me and said, "Oh, you know, what an honor how you influenced me." And then, without missing a beat, I said, "How about a rap on peace, right?" You know, and so he's sending me three or four lines on peace and Talib and death and people. Odine Pope, the great sax player, and Christy McBride, the bass player, are sending chords of peace. Right, so we would have the art, the music and the poetry and the children along the way, you know, and this is a struggle. But I have already had some person call me from Atlanta say, "Can you come help us do a mural of peace?" You see, we talk about our children, you know, who talk about hurting people or damning people. But unless we insinuate their eyes and their hands and hearts in this whole thing called peace, they will not be peaceful. And so what I'm asking the city of Philadelphia to do, since they made me the poet laureate there, right, that to do a mural of peace, and then we would have sidewalks of peace leading up to that mural of peace, right? We have flags of peace with the haiku that children will write, you know. And so I've been going to the schools, talking to children and teaching them, you know, about peace. You see, they give our children pills to calm them down. But you can go into a classroom and teach them how to breathe. And breathing correctly will calm them down. So before I start a workshop, I teach them how to breathe from here, as opposed to here, here, and here. You got to hear this. Because we all breathe badly, you know, whatever. When babies, we breathe right, but we learn, we get to be adults, and then we start breathing from up here, you know. But the moment I teach them how to breathe from here, they cough because it's all disturbed in here. So you teach them how to breathe from here, they see their stomach goes out. And then when they exhale, right, you know, then it comes in. And they're amazed by that, whatever. But what you do, you keep doing it with them, then you have a quiet class. You got to hear this, those who teach. You got to hear it, understand that. And so you have a quieter class working with you. And then you come forward, and you look at them, and then you have them face each other. Well, I had this extra person, this young brother was there. So I said, "I'm going to put my right hand on your heart, and you put your right hand on my heart," right? So he put your right hand. He got ready to put it on my heart. Here's my breast right here, right? So this poor kid like did like this, you know? So you have to hold his hand and say, I said, "My dear brother, you know, it's only a breast, you know, whatever, you know? You know, it is not porno, you know, whatever." And they fall out when you say porno, oh, whatever. But I said, "It's a breast." And, you know, and children, you know, breastfed there, but it's a breast. That's all it is, right, you know? And so put your hand on my breast, on my heart. I will put my hand on your heart. Not cover, but your left hand, cover my hand. And then by this time, they are just as noisy as they can be, people. And so you say, "Okay, everyone, keep quiet. Let us listen to each other's heartbeat." When you teach children to listen to each other's heartbeat, they begin looking at each other. "No, really, I see it." And you have to do it to see it. And they look like this, like, human being. This ain't no posse member, you know. This is no one to exploit. It's a human being. And that human heartbeat goes around the classroom. And you do that, you got them, by the way, is what I'm saying. And you can teach. And you can teach that haiku. Thank you, my sister. You can teach that haiku, which is peaceful. Because you see, the point of teaching the haiku is not just to have them learn a form, whatever. But the point of all these exercises is to talk about simply, my dear brothers and sisters, you know, how do you have a haiku way of life? Finally, you know, which is about peace. You're teaching peace. If you teach children how to breathe, you teach them peace and you teach them life. Not death, life. And that's what this is all about, teaching our children and ourselves about life. Okay?
Thank you so much for blessing us with all your remembrances.
That was poet, scholar, and activist Sonia Sanchez. Sanchez is professor emeritus at Temple University and was recently named Poet Laureate of Philadelphia. This conversation was recorded at UMKC. Hear the entire unedited version at kcur.org.